from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In 1819, the great poet Keats looked at Sir Isaac Newton's breakthrough discoveries and wrote that science explains too much, that it robs life of romance. Science, complained Keats, unweaves the rainbow. And he hadn't seen anything yet. In the 21st century, says our guest tonight, science will explain away the human soul itself. Tonight on Point, Yale psychologist Paul Bloom on the biochemistry of the soul and the next great battleground of faith and science. But first tonight, presidential candidate Ralph Nader has bounced on and off the Florida ballot all this week. Republicans have fought in court to keep him on. Democrats want him off. Tonight, the Florida Supreme Court has ruled that Mr. Nader will be on the Florida ballot. Joining us with the latest news from Tallahassee is John Kennedy, bureau chief there for the Orlando Sentinel. John, what has the court ruled?
Well, the court has ruled in a 6-1 decision that Nader should be on the ballot. Basically, they're pinning their decision to the fact that Florida law does not really define what a national party is, nor what a national convention is when trying to look at Nader's candidacy. Democrats in the state had tried to knock him off the ballot, fearing chiefly that he's going to draw votes away from John Kerry, but claiming that the Reform Party, which is the banner he's running on here, is not truly a national party, nor did they nominate him at a proper national convention.
And so this ruling, 6-1 ruling by the Florida High Court, puts him on the absentee ballots and the November 2nd ballot, John?
That's right. He's on the ballot all around.
It's been quite a saga this week. Walk us through some of the steps in this tennis match. It's been really something.
Oh, absolutely. It began last week in a nighttime hearing where a circuit court judge here in Tallahassee listened to testimony from Democrats and their witnesses who basically built a case against the Reform Party. The judge heard the arguments largely from one side and issued a temporary injunction which knocked Nader off the ballot. Nader had already been certified for the Florida ballot by Governor Jeb Bush, the president's brother.
And this was Lawrence Tribe arguing for the position in Florida? Is that right?
Today it was Lawrence Tribe.
Okay,
Tribe came before the Supreme Court today, Harvard constitutional law expert.
But last week the judge said he's off.
Yeah, last week the judge said he was off. That ruling then ultimately became appealed by Governor Bush's appointed Secretary of State, Glenda Hood.
Mm-hmm.
When she appealed that order, that basically stayed the temporary injunction, and in that time, Hood put Nader back on the ballot. Despite the court's ruling, and that is really what started the ping-pong match.
It's quite something. So now it's gone to the high court. Are absentee ballots going out very soon now? So have localities printed them up, or how's it physically happening?
Well, it's been kind of a mess, and that's what led to today's rare ruling by the Supreme Court, and rare in this sense. They heard oral arguments this morning, and here tonight they've ruled. This is very hurry-up jurisprudence by Florida standards. And the reason being that there is a state law that tomorrow absentee ballots must go out to military and overseas voters. That tomorrow is 45 days before the November 2nd election.
And of course, in 2000, those votes made the difference that ultimately, along with the Supreme Court, put George Bush in the White House and
right.
Al Gore in the wilderness. What do the polls show this year? We can't assume that Florida will be the make-or-break state again this year, but what do they look like, John? How close is it there? What difference might Ralph Nader's candidacy on the ballot make?
Well, Nader is a wild card again now that he's back on. This state has, according to the most recent polls now, which go back a while, because we have been pummeled by hurricanes over the last 5 weeks, and by virtue of that, there are not too many survey companies out there in the field taking the temperature of Florida voters. But the last polls back in early August and mid-August had a deadlock in Florida. Florida is one of those battleground states that's really up for grabs. Where it stands now, it's kind of hard to say because the surveyors have stayed away.
Is there any appeal to this decision today, or is it do the printing presses roll and it's a done deal?
It looks like the printing presses will roll. The Democratic Party tells me tonight that they have no plans to challenge this. There is still a question about. There were four voters supported by an organization called the Ballot Project, a independent organization, but which has a lot of former Democratic lawmakers and activists on their board. That the Ballot Project has been challenging Nader across the battleground states. Whether they're going to try to find some avenue of appeal, I haven't gotten a solid answer yet at this hour, but if the Democrats are running up the white flag right now, I think the Ballot Project may too.
So tonight it looks as though Ralph Nader will be full and thoroughly on the ballot in Florida. John Kennedy, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
John Kennedy is Tallahassee Bureau Chief for the Orlando Sentinel. He joined me from Florida. Galileo turned over the church's notion of the cosmos. Darwin upset its beliefs on the origin of humankind. But the 21st century battleground between faith and science may go to the final frontier. Our guest tonight, Yale psychologist Paul Bloom, points out that science is rapidly defining the soul itself as biochemistry, an earthly product of neurons and evolution that is thoroughly of the flesh. Tonight on Point, faith, science, and the soul itself as biochemistry. If science proves that everything is body chemistry, even what we've called the soul, does that leave room for faith? And if religion choked on evolution, what will it do with this science? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Later in the hour, we'll be joined by Harvard Medical School professor Armand Nicolai, creator of the PBS series that aired this week across the country, The Question of God. But right now, we're joined from New Haven, Connecticut, by Yale psychology professor Paul Bloom. He is author of Descartes' Baby, How the Science of Child Development Explains What Makes Us Human. His recent New York Times op-ed piece said that the duel between body and soul is essentially over, that humans are all body, even what we call the soul, and science now proves it. Good evening and welcome, Paul Bloom.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for having me here.
Wonderful to have you. We're looking forward to the conversation. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guest.
Hi.
So, Paul Bloom, we know that you didn't do all this science. You didn't come up with this. You are, in some sense, merely the messenger. But the message that you delivered in the last couple of weeks that caught our eye, you said that there's a new faith-science standoff brewing, and the science is going to be a much harder pill to swallow, your words, than evolution was for the church and for people of faith. What is that pill that in the 21st century the faithful are going to have to swallow, that science is going to deliver, Paul Bloom?
Well, I'm a developmental psychologist, and my work is with young children. And what I've learned from young children and looking at adults is that we're natural dualists. We see body and soul as separate. We see the soul as immaterial, perhaps immortal, surviving destruction of the body. And what my book is about, in part, my op-ed piece, is about how badly this clashes with what we know from science. So science tells us that the soul is flesh, that our mental life and our consciousness and our experiences and our morality are the products of a very physical brain. That's a clash that I'm interested in. And I think that this is, in some way, a more serious clash than that which we had over evolutionary theory and creationism. It's more serious because there's more at stake here.
And that is clearly recognized. You quote John Paul II saying that bodies themselves may have evolved, but that theories which, to quote him, consider the spirit as emerging from the forces of living matter or as a mere epiphenomenon of this matter are incompatible with the truth about man. The line is very clearly drawn there. He's saying something quite contrary to what you're reporting from the world of science.
He is, and it's a big clash. I mean, there's been clashes before over astronomy, over physics, and over evolution. But I think this one is central. I think religion could learn to cope with evolutionary theory, could learn to cope with the fact that the Earth revolves around the sun. But many religious beliefs are really invested in the idea of an immaterial soul. And so the clash, and this makes so much sense to us. It's so intuitive. I've argued that young children tacitly believe in this immaterial soul.
And you say that on the big screen or in literature, but in movies, let's say, Freaky Friday, where characters trade body, or Big, where the soul of a 13-year-old is suddenly in the body of Tom Hanks, we intuitively believe this. This seems to make sense. The soul, something portable, separate, not of the flesh, even could be pop into another body.
Absolutely. And that's, I think, the clearest sign of how natural our dualism is. We see these movies, all of us, me too, and we understand them. They make sense to us. Nobody needs to explain Big to us or The Exorcist. And, of course, this isn't Hollywood invention. And, you know, Homer wrote about his soldiers being turned into pigs.
But yet they had the souls of the soldiers, even when they were physically pigs.
Exactly. And you read this story, and it makes sense to you. No three-year-old has ever balked at the idea of a Power Ranger transforming into another creature or of another boy leaving his body in the course of a dream. This is common sense to us.
So
it's literally common sense.
But you say that this common sense is now running up against what science understands. You say that the qualities of mental life that we associate with souls are purely corporeal. They emerge from biochemical processes in the brain. I wish you'd explain this a little further, because I think an awful lot of people are going to intuitively reject this notion. So please lay it out in more detail. What do you mean, the qualities of mental life we associate with the soul, first of all? And then what do you mean they emerge from biochemistry?
Well, the qualities of mental life we associate with the soul, I'm viewing as things like our consciousness, our experience, our central emotions like love and pity and compassion, our morality, our will, our ability to block evil desires and to try to be better people. Those are what people historically have viewed as the province of the soul, as what's special to us, perhaps what survives the destruction of our body. And what science tells us, and this is not a new idea, many theologians, in fact, have struggled with this claim, and it's been around for a long time, but I think it's becoming more and more uncontroversial. What science tells us is that these aspects we identify as the soul are very real. There definitely is consciousness and moral thought and
mm-hmm.
will
mm-hmm.
of some sort, but they're not immaterial. They're the products of our physical brains. And we know that now from so many ways. I mean, you could go to any hospital or university and watch, you know, your brain light up in different ways when you use different parts of these capacities. And sadly, you can see what happens in cases of brain damage or disease or stroke where people lose some of these capacities. There's disorders, for instance, called acquired psychopathy, where someone gets bopped on the head and then loses their moral self-control.
So you're essentially suggesting that the idea of the soul is just a word to describe what was ignorance. And now science says, no, there's physical explanations for all of this.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, I'm not denying it. It's perfectly fine to talk about a soul and invest in all of these precious values, and I think it's very real. What one has to give up, though, is the notion that this soul is non-physical, that it's separate from the body.
So if this is all known, why do you think the 21st century is going to turn into a battleground over it on the faith-science front?
Well, I think it's becoming more and more known in the popular press. I think that there's the word is getting out in more and more ways, in part because of advances in technology, in genomics and brain imaging. So it's not surprising anymore these days to read in the newspaper that someone, you know, thinks about sex and parts of their brain light up, or that Democrats think differently than Republicans, as discovered by brain scans.
Jack Beatty, join us here for a moment before the break. This is knocking away an awful lot. We couldn't have the Earth at the center of the universe. We couldn't have Genesis. Now we can't have human souls.
Turns out the soul is mortal as well. Descartes thought it was in the pineal gland. He gave it that much corporeal reality, but of course, upon investigation, it didn't show up there. You know, these things are trials for faith, but there's the other argument, which is that they purify faith. That if in fact all the facts are against faith, everything, no soul, no evidence of God's existence up and down the line, no spirituality even, that's just chemistry, you can believe against the facts. What did St. Paul call faith? The evidence of things unseen. Well, these sorts of things say you're going to see less and less and less. And what we do see is saying there's no soul, which the person of faith can say, well, now I have a pure faith. I believe against all the facts.
And yet, I don't know, Jack, the soul, I thought the soul was the vehicle that was going to get us all up to heaven if we were on the right side of things. This goes against an awful lot, an awful long time of human thinking. Jack Beatty, Paul Bloom, stand by. We're talking tonight about the central battleground of faith and science in the 21st century, science's increasingly loud assertion that the soul is just biochemistry. What do you think? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about the looming battleground of faith and science in this century. Science's increasingly loud assertion that the soul, the human soul itself, is just body chemistry. It's not separate from the body. It's a product of the body. It is flesh. It flies in the face of an awful lot of religious teaching and spiritual assumption for maybe forever. Our guest tonight from New Haven, Connecticut, is Paul Bloom, professor of psychology at Yale and author of Descartes' Baby. You can join the conversation as well. What do you think? Will 21st century science explain away the very idea of an eternal soul? And if science proves that everything is body chemistry, even what we've called the spirit, does that leave room for faith? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We are joined right now from Concord, Massachusetts, by Armand Nicolai. He is professor at Harvard University Medical School. He's creator of the PBS series A Question of God, which has been airing across the country this week, and we're delighted to have him with us tonight. Armand Nicolai, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
So here we are. Paul Bloom has put this right under our noses. You have paid a lot of attention for a long time to the fact that science and faith had a very rich 20th century kind of confrontation and opposing views. You particularly have looked at Sigmund Freud and C.S. Lewis. In the new science that's unfolding around and before us now, do you see a new depth of challenge to faith emerging?
If you look at the at what scientists themselves believe in terms of their worldviews, you find that some of the studies among the most eminent scientists find that at least 40 and 50% of them believe in the spiritual worldview with all of the assumptions that that have been held, namely that there is a soul, and the soul is something apart from what we know as the physical body. There have been long arguments and discussions about whether or not the mind is and brain are one. Some people say yes, definitely. Others see the mind as something apart from the brain.
But what we're hearing tonight, and Paul Bloom, join us here. I hear you saying that, in your view anyway, that debate is over, that the mind and brain, the soul and body are one, which is a kind of way of saying there is no soul, certainly no eternal soul.
Well, I think that that's right, but I agree with what Dr. Nicolai is saying. I think that our dualistic perspective, our intuitive beliefs in souls separate from bodies, is extraordinarily hard to shake, and we never actually do shake it. So the finding of a scientist is exactly right. And I think many of my colleagues, you know, on the one hand, do this work showing how the brain is responsible for emotions and memory and consciousness. And on the other hand, hold maybe a deeper faith in an immaterial soul. I think it exists on two levels.
But are you suggesting, Paul Bloom, that science is going to put the facts so clearly in the face of humans that dualism is going to be challenged? Seems to me you clearly are.
Yes, I think it definitely is a challenge. I think that, and people have to learn to cope with this in different ways. I imagine that there are people with fundamentalist views, for instance, have to face that challenge over evolutionary biology. I think that debate has pretty much, you know, come pretty much to an end.
Though not to an end, I must say. I mean, it's still disputed in textbooks, and you know that story.
It's true, but there's definitely a trend. It's less disputed than it was 20 years ago and much less than it was 40 years ago. And it's very difficult to find people who would argue that the human race, appeared 5,000 years ago with no evolutionary process. I'm not sure what's going to happen with body-soul dualism. I'm actually partially pessimistic. If you give up on body-soul dualism, for instance, you give up on many conceptions of life after death. And that's not small potatoes.
But you're suggesting it's not a matter of just giving up, that science is going to put evidence before us all that's going to be increasingly difficult to deny.
Well, put it this way, it's not just science. Within the Christian faith, theologians for a long time have argued against a sort of common sense notion of heaven and hell. They believe in souls, but they believe that souls do not survive the destruction of the body. So many theologians reject it. Mainstream Christians, almost all of them, 95% according to a poll that I just read, believe in heaven. It's a very unshakable view. Science won't shake it, maybe, and I don't think even theology will shake it.
Armand Nicolai, you've looked in particular at the views of Sigmund Freud and C.S. Lewis. Of course, Freud, a great non-believer who referenced science a lot. C.S. Lewis, who began as a non-believer and converted to a very rich belief. How do you think they would look on this new frontier of debate?
Well, Lewis makes an interesting statement. He says that the philosophy that we bring to the evidence and to experience influences how we interpret that evidence. You know that you take two scientists that come at data from two different paradigms, can look at the same data and come away with entirely different interpretations of that data. So I think Lewis has a point when he says the philosophy that we bring to the evidence influences how we interpret that evidence.
So offering that by way of saying you're really not accepting what Paul Bloom is saying, that science is proving that the soul is flesh. You're simply not willing to accept that.
I think that how that's interpreted depends on the philosophy of the person observing it, what he brings to his observations. Now you take the observation that a certain part of the brain lights up when a person's praying. Well, you know, you can say that this is evidence that this is just the chemical activity of the brain. Or you can say, well, you know, if there's a creator and he created us to have a relationship with him, well, of course there would be a part of the brain that was made to deal with this relationship. So you see, how you interpret that depends on the philosophy that you bring to it.
Paul Bloom, this gets right down to brass tacks. What do you hear from Armand Nicolai? Is this part of the confrontation? Do you hear faith rather than science? Do you buy that it all depends on the philosophy you bring? You've written very clearly, modern science tells us, you've written, that the conscious self arises from a purely physical brain. We do not have immaterial souls. Armand Nicolai says, well, that depends on the philosophy you bring to the science. Do you agree?
I think Dr. Nicolai is right in how people treat the evidence and approach the evidence. I think the same could be said about evolution, in that some people look at the evidence and then they say, well, you know, the fossil evidence was put there by God to test our faith. But I think in the end, pretty much soon the evidence in a fair-minded and objective sense favors certain views and not others. At one point it was respectable to believe that, you know, the Earth was the center of the universe. Now it's not. And so even putting aside the question how this particular issue is going to eventually turn out, I think that it is going to be something which is resolvable and understandable in terms of scientific method and scientific understanding.
Jack Beatty, what do you hear in this very interesting conversation? Here we've got a Harvard Medical School professor and a Yale psychologist. This is even before we get out to the great public. And they're not finding common ground on the basics. I mean, Armand Nicolai is essentially contesting what Paul Bloom says is fact.
Well, he's relativizing it. He's saying we have magnets in our minds, and they're going to be drawn to what they're going to be drawn to. And this is the more pragmatic view of science, for that matter, and of faith, that if it works for you, if it answers some question in your life, then you stay with it. But, you know, I do think that if 95% of people believe in heaven, and some large fraction of them must believe in a soul that goes there, this kind of thing is going to be shaking. And, you know, it's interesting. Faith was drifting away from materialism in the 19th century. I mean, the theologians were making their peace with evolution,
right,
certainly with, the Charles Lyell and the history of the universe and so on.
Mm.
But then, along came fundamentalism, which was a reaction precisely to the advances of science. Now, if that pattern holds true, we could be in for a new age of even deeper fundamentalism, where the energy of denial, which I think is really at the bottom of fundamentalism, or a positive way would be the energy of affirmation, I believe, that the encroachments of science on the spirit might even actually create a new wave of faith.
Wow. And a more intense than conflict than might otherwise be.
Mm-hmm.
I want to bring our callers in here.
Possible.
Paul Bloom, I hear you there. You think it's possible that greater intensity of what you would call denial or turn to fundamentalism may be in reaction to this science?
I think that's quite possible. I mean, I would prefer a more optimistic outcome, which is that people of faith would try to, in some way, make peace with the way the world turns out to be. And that's happened in other domains like, you know, astronomy and physical evolution. And I would hope that it happens here.
But this one is pretty tough. If you say there's no immortal soul, there's not even a dualism during life. There's no spirit or soul that stands above, apart, even during life. I mean, that's sort of kicking away many people's ladder to heaven or even to peace of mind during this life. I want to turn to our callers. Carl is calling from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Carl, what do you think?
It's hard to reconcile two things that are coming from totally different areas of thought. I mean, materialism, the materialistic area, which is supported by science, says is the basis of all reality. And so if you bring in something that is non-material and you say that emotions are real, for instance, I think in our society we say that thought is real and physical and the material is real, mm-hmm. but we don't say that relationships are real. We don't say that emotions are real. Because they can't be measured. And if you look at the stratification of, the rock formation, and you say, okay, this is what it looks like, here's the layers.
Here's the dinosaur bone, here's the ape, here's the missing link, yep.
Okay, so as soon as you start saying why it's there or what caused it to be there, you're only getting closer in approximation. You cannot get causality through falsification.
Falsification. So you're looking at the material explanation and rejecting it as a fundamental explanation for what's going on.
I think that our new fundamentalism is materialism. Fundamentalism always has the consoling nature of it. There's a consolation prize in any fundamentalism. Just save the whales and everything will be all right. Just go to therapy, everything will be all right. Just believe in Jesus and everything will be all right. Trust science and everything will be all right. There is a clear and definite consolation or consoling nature of fundamentalism. And I sort of take my stand with Martin Buber that says, I do not want to hang out in a social and cosmic homelessness that the materialistic world presents to me. I would rather move into faith, and I'm done talking and taking.
We've got it, Carl. Thank you so much for your call. That's terrific. Paul Bloom, we are in an age when people juggle ideas in a very nifty way. Here Carl's turning it around and saying, my friend, you're the fundamentalist. There's kind of relativism here. Materialism itself, science itself, is a kind of fundamentalism.
Well, here's the difference, though. Science is open to criticism and counter-argument and falsification. So you go to a conference on emotions, and you have people with different views on the brain locations responsible for anger. So this person says it's in the amygdala, this person says it's in some other area, a third person says it's diffuse in the whole brain. And if Carl were to argue, no, it's none of those, it's immaterial and it's separate and it has no brain correspondence, he would get to have his say. And people would say, well, what evidence do you have?
Mm-hmm.
And I take it that this openness to argument and falsification is what distinguishes science from a fundamentalist view.
Aman Nikolai, let me ask you this. If Paul Bloom is pointing out, and Jack Beatty as well, that religion has come to terms with a number of world-rocking insights. It happened in the time of Galileo eventually. It's happened since Darwin to a great extent. Can you imagine, is it possible for faith to go on if at some point, I know you think this won't happen, but if people do come to see the soul itself as a kind of, fireworks display of neurons and body chemicals and not divine, is there then still room for faith, still room for belief in God?
Oh,
I think I think that our knowledge of the universe, and we'll just take the brain. The brain is the most complicated apparatus that we know of in the entire universe. And the more we know about it, the more we find out about it, the more aware we are of how much we don't know. So I don't think that we're ever going to get to the point where we have, you know, we feel that we have a complete understanding of it. I think our understanding of it has continued to change in the past and will continue to change in the future.
Boy, but it can sure rock the boat. Let's take another call. Steve is calling from Kingsville, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have two quick points. I want to say, first of all, there's a nonprofit here in Boston that examines these very issues and their personal and social implications, and it's called the Center for Naturalism, and it's at naturalism.org.
Got it. And your second point?
Accepting the idea that everything about us, including thoughts, emotions, and desires, is connected to the causal chain that goes all the way back to the Big Bang, that leads us to a more truly compassionate view of ourselves, since we no longer see individuals as the ultimate causes of their behavior. And it also leads to a better understanding of the material world, which, you know, the WYSIWYG world, the what you see is what you get world, and that lets us value that world more than it would if we had souls.
So you're saying you actually find comfort in this view, Steve?
Absolutely. The more knowledge you know about yourself, the better off you are.
Steve, thanks for your call. Jack Beatty, how about that? Do you need the buffer of the soul, that dualism, or are you willing to just be, you know, what was it in Monty Python or I'm not sure where, the ugly bag of mostly water?
Well, I've got some. I'm
sorry.
Oh,
nothing
some
personal,
beer in
Jack.
There.
You're a handsome fellow.
Well, you know, he said something very interesting, which is the connection between the dualism and the dominion that Western man, maybe humans as a whole, have sought to exercise over nature as if they were over and against nature. As if nature were the other whom we should conquer. And a view that says, no, 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 we're all continuous right up to our thoughts, right up to our poetry. We're all continuous with that nature. There is no spirit. I just think that might be more respectful of the planet, that we are the planet. We're not over and against it. We're just an ambulatory wing of it.
And maybe then a more harmonious relationship with it, but that's sure taking away the source of an awful lot of succor.
Well, that's true. I mean, people have, our whole civilization is built on dominion over nature, and I think it's been in no small degree fed by this dualism, a sort of secular version of it.
Wow, and here it comes. More science, Paul Bloom says, that is going to put this view more and more and more right in front of us. How will we deal with it? Our guest tonight, Paul Bloom, professor of psychology at Yale, author of Descartes' Baby. Dr. Armand Nicolai, professor of Harvard Medical School and creator of A Question of God. You may have seen it on PBS this week. You can join the conversation tonight. Do you believe that science is capable of entirely explaining you all the way in to what you call your soul? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the central battleground of faith and science in the 21st century. It's shaping up. Science is increasingly loud assertion that the soul itself is just biochemistry. You can join the conversation tonight. Does this science leave you feeling naked, empty, or will you refuse to concede that science can explain everything, even the human soul? And are faith and science headed here for an ultimate showdown or a new understanding? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by Paul Bloom, Armand Nicolai, and our own Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation as well. David's calling from Greensboro, North Carolina. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
A few points. I'll try to make them quickly. First of all, as I understand it, biblical scholars are fairly well agreed now that Jewish people of Jesus' era took a mainly monistic view of human beings, and that the dualistic view was something that was added later by the early church fathers, Clement of Alexandria, people like that who were Neoplatonist. Later on, when Aristotelian philosophy became the center of or the main philosophy, especially with Aquinas, he took something, the kind of view of Aristotle, which was that the soul is the form of the body. And there was a lot of controversy over those kind of statements. And then to bring up to the modern age and modern philosophy of mind, there's a specific kind of a relation called supervenience, which is a reaction, or has become into popularity as a reaction against sort of positivistic views of philosophy, which most scientists take, which would kind of reduce everything to the simplest, kind of reductionist view of the world. So rocks and trees and things like that are just collections of atoms. The problem with that view is you can't explain what makes one collection different from another.
David, is your bottom line then that dualism's not necessary to a faith vision of the world?
That is one point, because I think it's been a debate in the church that's actually gone on for quite a while. There are two views. One is that the soul is immortal, and the other is that it's not immortal, but that God completely reinstates the soul, or,
David, let us pick all that up. You've given us quite a lot to chew on there. Armand, Nikolai, how about this issue of dualism itself? Do you see that as, in your reading, is that seen as essential to a life of faith, that there is this dualism, that there's the corporeal body and something higher, finer, closer to the divine?
I'm not a theologian and nor a philosopher. So.
But you're a reader, all right, and a teacher.
And I of the people that I know in science, I find that they hold one of two worldviews. They're either materialists that believe that we don't really know how the universe came about, that it just happened, and then there are those scientists with some kind of what they would call a spiritual worldview, where they begin with the assumption, the philosophical assumption, that there's an intelligence beyond the universe that gives the universe order and human life and life meaning.
And how does this relate to the question of whether or not human beings have souls? Is that entirely independent of that issue? Have souls in the dualistic sense?
I think that most people that embrace a spiritual worldview believe that death is not extinction. They believe, as C.S. Lewis does, that it's just the end of the first chapter of a book that goes on without end.
Paul Bloom, you say quite explicitly, death is extinction, and science proves it. Does it prove it now in a way that it didn't a century ago when Sigmund Freud and later C.S. Lewis were looking at this?
Well, I'm not a relativist or a pragmatist on this issue. It might turn out that there is an afterlife and modern science is wrong. And if so, it would be, extraordinarily important to know. I think there's a fact of the matter either way. And I look at it somewhat differently than thinking about in terms of different worldviews or perspectives. Mm. Either we survive destruction of our bodies or we don't. And the answer from neuroscience and psychology is that, say, memories, are neural structures in the brain. They're not ephemeral spiritual things. They're not, vibrations in some immaterial soul. They're structures in the brain. And this is the modern scientific perspective on what memories are, and if that's what memories are, then when your brain goes, they go too. If you want to believe in an afterlife, the more respectable way to do so, as I think our caller mentioned, is to believe that God will recreate your body and recreate your brain, hence give you back your memories.
Presto.
But absent that, memories go when your brain goes. Now, it could turn out science has proven to be wrong before. It could turn out that some genius scientist, philosopher will make a discovery and find out brains are actually, spiritual patterns. But it would really be a discovery. I think that there are serious facts of the matter here. And what I present in my op-ed piece and in my book is the current scientific picture as to the way things are.
Is, in your view then, in that picture, is there room for a reasonable person to also be a person of faith? Or is that simply outmoded, as Freud might have said a century ago?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Nothing in what I talk about, for instance, pertains to the existence or non-existence of God. I don't have anything interesting or creative to say about that, and that's sort of an independent issue. Also, you could be a person of faith without believing in an immaterial and an immortal soul. A lot of Christian theologians have held a belief where they were very skeptical about an immaterial soul. I think, however, that the way it just works out is that most people of faith do believe in a soul. The vast, vast majority do. And so to make their faith consistent with the science, the faith is going to have to change in some important ways.
That's exactly what I was getting to. What kind of evolution of faith do you imagine? If faith should come to conform to the set of facts as you present them?
Well, you could believe in a God that created, that was involved in the creation of humans, where human thought and consciousness was a product of their physical bodies. You could hold moral and maybe even spiritual views that don't require supernatural entities. I think one of the callers before alluded to a very important point, which is a belief in an afterlife and a belief in a soul doesn't necessarily make us better people. It's easy to think of cases where it makes us much worse people, as when people do horrific things because they believe they'll be rewarded in an afterlife, or when people show gross disregard for other people because they say, well, it's just their bodies, just their lives. Mm. They'll get their just rewards in heaven. Let's not worry about the way they are now.
And so conceivably, it could make for a greater awareness of good on this earth. Tracy's calling from Lakefield, Rhode Island. Hi, Tracy. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing?
Great. Thanks, Tracy.
I just want to establish where I'm coming from, and that is I believe in evolution and I believe in science, but I also believe in the existence of some kind of eternal component to the human experience.
I think most people do, right?
Yeah, I think you can call it a soul, you can call it a spiritual aspect, you can call it your tie with the eternal, but I think that, I mean, we have our corporeal existence and that it ends, but I think that we have an eternal existence. So, and I tell you why, because human beings, the existence of human beings in the nature of the universe and in evolution makes no sense if there's not something beyond this. And I'll tell you, there's three reasons why. I try to be succinct because I know time
okay.
is of the
yeah.
essence. One is that scientists have agreed and state that the nature of the universe is to tend toward chaos, which is called entropy. And yet we have evolution, which is the nature of nature to become more and more highly organized.
Okay.
So there's a creative force there which has not been identified. It's just been noted that there are two postulates. They postulate these two things. This
yep.
is what's happening.
Yep.
That's
yep.
what's happening. The reason that it shifts from chaos to organization is not questioned. It just is.
Tracy, let me ask you something.
Yes.
If science were to prove beyond any shred of doubt somehow that there, as Paul Bloom is saying, is essentially already proven, that there is no soul beyond the body, could you accept that? Or is there any way you would be open to that? Or are you simply, I mean, put yourself in the shoes, you know, of the Pope looking at Galileo and saying, I just can't accept this. Or people looking at Charles Darwin and saying, I just can't accept this. Do you ever fear, with your view of things, that you may just be stuck in a blind spot?
No, I'll tell you what. I'm a kind of an optimist person. I always will leave a little door open somewhere. If they prove without a doubt there's absolutely nothing happening beyond, let's say I died and went and saw absolute blackness, came back and said, all right, well, I have to go on with the rest of my life.
Yeah.
I proved it to myself. Nobody told me.
Right.
I proved it to myself. I would have to say I will need to have a little bit of doubt always left. And that's where you come in with the independent investigation of the truth. You have to know for yourself, but you also have to know that there's always room for human error. We're human beings. We're going to make mistakes.
It sounds like you and many people want to hold open that hatch here and hold it up open vigorously. Tracy, thanks for your call. Armand Nicolai, I want to come to a point that you've talked about, again, coming back to Freud and C.S. Lewis, about which of these men, Freud, who embraced science and not faith, C.S. Lewis, who richly embraced faith, which of them ended up happier? You quote them very colorfully, and you describe very colorfully which was happier. Share that with us.
I think, in my book, I try to describe their worldviews, and they both began life very much alike. Both of them were very intelligent. Both of them came from religious homes. Freud from a Jewish religious home, and Lewis from an Irish Protestant home. And both of them, as soon as they began to develop their intellect, both of them were very, very bright, threw over this nominal childhood faith that they had. And both of them became atheists. And as atheists, they both describe a great deal of pessimism in their lives, and introversion, and wariness of other people. Freud said that most human beings, in his opinion, were trash, and was very disappointed in his relationships with other people, and Lewis was. But after Lewis's a change of worldview, he began to turn outward, he said. It was the beginning of his turning outward, and he began to see and understand people in a different way. And his friends say became much more cheerful and outgoing and developed a close group of friends, the Inklings, Tolkien being one of them.
J.R. Tolkien, of course.
Was a great influence in his life,
Let me put that to Paul Bloom. Paul, is it possible that human nature, scientifically described, requires a belief in the soul, the spirit, the transcendent, the dual, to be happy? Is it possible that maybe we've sort of reached the limits here, at the frontier you describe, of what we're willing to take on from science, because we're happier without it?
Well, I could go back to your own example, which is, who was happier, Galileo or the Pope? And I don't know. Maybe the Pope was happier. Maybe, you know, the discoveries that Galileo made were rather depressing. But, you know, one of the hallmarks of being an adult is, you know, you go for the truth, even if it could be disheartening. And so it might in the end turn out that people who believe in souls are happier. And it might in the end turn out that people who believe in divine creation or that the earth is the center of the universe are happier. It wouldn't even surprise me if that were true. These are very reassuring views. They're very cheering. Mm-hmm. But I think that as adults, as you know, educated, literate people who are trying to use our minds, that can't be where we stop. We have to say we want to know the way things really are.
Do you think it's possible to believe something that you don't really think is true?
Absolutely. I can think of dozens of examples. One example is I think we intuitively believe, just like we believe in souls, we intuitively believe that objects are solid through and through. You bump into it, you bang into it, it's solid. Babies know this. Children know this, and adults know this.
And yet science says there's a lot of space in that brick.
Science says it's particles and fields of energy. And so what we do as adults is we walk around with both of these facts. We walk around the scientific view and the common sense view.
With that, we're out of time. I think we've laid out the battle lines. We'll see how they play out, and it will be some kind of battle. Armand Nicolai, creator of A Question of God and author of A Question of God, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you for inviting me.
And Paul Bloom, professor of psychology at Yale and author of Descartes' Baby. Wonderful, fascinating. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Jack Beatty, there goes that soul I was counting on. I'm not sure I'm ready to give mine up.
I'm going to give Woody Allen the last line. Where is the afterlife and how far is it from Midtown?
Jack, thanks for being with us. This is On Point.